very excited to be sitting here right now with James Wilcox from Untamed Borders. If you've never heard of him, it's more of a case of if you've never heard of him yet, because he's starting to become a bit of a known entity, a bit of a known quantity, a bit of a renowned expert when it comes to destinations that have a high element of perceived danger. So most notably, in my view anyway, Afghanistan, Somaliland, Sudan, Iraq are just a few countries that his company has led groups to. And there's such a long list, actually, when you're reading about James on the internet. It's hard to summarize your profile, James, but you ran the first skiing trips in the history of Afghanistan. Did I read that correctly?
Hi, Matt. No, well, first, thanks for having us on the show. I think we ran the first commercial ski trips. I mean, I don't think we can claim to have arranged the first people ever to have skied in Afghanistan. There's someone has done something before, but absolutely the first commercial ski trips to Afghanistan, the first commercial ski trips to Iraq.
As well. It's people often ask me as an Australian, they're surprised that we have snow in Australia, but I think you must get similar reactions when people find out you're doing ski trips to Afghanistan and Iraq.
Absolutely. And actually it's one of the things I really like about the ski trips is, as well as, you know, organizing travel, that's what we do for a business. One of the things we really like to do in the countries that we guide in is to, through our communities, through the people we guide, through everything that we do, try and show them, you know, the multifaceted places that they are. Like every country, it has loads of different stuff going on, rather than somewhere like Afghanistan or Iraq. They're almost defined internationally by extremism or violence or wars. And so if you say, oh, we're going skiing in Afghanistan, as you said, people don't know there's any snow, so already their mind has been changed. You know, if it's possible to go skiing in somewhere that I thought was a desert, yeah, maybe it's possible that everything isn't a disaster in that country and there's actually beautiful things to see and interesting stuff. So I'm always excited about saying we organize skiing in the countries that we guide in, because it already starts to open people's minds to the possibility that there's more in parts of the world than their preconceptions.
So these are kind of backcountry skiing kind of trips. I can imagine there's no ski lifts yet in Afghanistan, or have I got that wrong as well?
In Afghanistan, it's all backcountry, ski touring backcountry, which if you love, you know, backcountry skiing, if you pitch it as skiing without the lifts, it sounds awful. If you pitch it as hiking around in the mountains, but instead of walking down, you have to ski, it's a wonderful experience. But in Iraq, there's actually, you can Google it, there's 200 meters, and that's meters, not kilometers, of groomed piste in Iraq. In the early 2000s, the semi-autonomous Kurdish region started to develop, had a lot of oil money, and they were looking for different projects. And I think they call it, is it the snow center or the winter center? It's basically a cable car up into the mountains where people go and hang out and see snow. And they've got a groom pisting machine and 200 meters of groomed piste. So Iraq has a tiny bit of piste, but yeah, basically it's backcountry skiing in both.
Wow. So we have to go all the way back to the start, I think. How did all of this happen?
I like to travel, and I think for people that end up going to sort of slightly more interesting places, it's like a gateway drug or something like that. Because when I first started traveling, there wasn't much on the way of information on the internet. You know, people bought a Lonely Planet or they bought a guidebook and you went, and then other people gave you information on the road about going to another place. And you slowly started getting off the beaten path. And I found that really exciting. You were going to places where you didn't see the country, you didn't see the place through the prism of tourism. And I really enjoyed that. I really liked seeing something for what it is, not because there's lots of tourists there and that's why it's like it is. And so that naturally led me to places where there wasn't so much tourism. So I was traveling in Iran and in Pakistan and in Afghanistan. And during that time, I met a couple of guys, one from Pakistan, one from Afghanistan. And they predominantly worked professional people, with photographers, with journalists, with researchers, with documentary makers. But they also worked with tourists. So they wanted to do more tourist stuff because as I said before, they wanted to portray their countries in the way that they saw them, not as places that just have to be reported on because there's problems, or be fixed because there's problems. You know, there's an incredible beauty in history and culture. And they wanted to set up a company. And this was like 2007, 2008, the early days of social media and websites and things. So I built a website. I say built a website. I got someone to build a website for them, and we set up a Facebook page. And this is what you did back in 2008. And after sort of 6 months of trying to help them out and answering things for them, I was like, actually, there's a business here. This could be a dream job for me. So the three of us restructured it. We registered it in the UK, and yeah, we started in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And now we guide in maybe sort of 30 countries from Central Africa, North Africa, East Africa, and Middle East, and into Central Asia.
Wow.
And those two business partners, are they still in the picture today?
Yeah, one of them's still in the picture today. I was chatting to him last night. We restarted our trips to Afghanistan at the end of last summer. Obviously, there's a new government there. The Taliban are now in control there, so we had a bit of a pause. And so we've been doing a lot of stuff. It's kind of, for Afghanistan, not exactly like starting again, but relearning certain things, going to places we couldn't go before because of the security situation has changed. So yeah, it's been the last year's been quite interesting for us. You know, we've worked together for so long, but we're starting doing something that we know very well, but in a different way. So yeah, we're still working together.
I can imagine that a lot of things have changed. So when it comes to Afghanistan, how has it changed? So with the Taliban coming in, I can't imagine it's necessarily every single thing has turned for the worse for tourism, or travel itself. So what does the new situation look like?
Well, I mean, it depends on who you are. Like with any change of government, some people win and some people lose. And obviously, you don't need to tell me that the female population in Afghanistan, specifically in sort of urban areas and people who are educated, they're the losers. I mean, I sit on the board of an organization that provides safe space for women to do sports in post-conflict countries. We had a big program in Afghanistan, and that's almost zero now, because it's not completely zero. There's stuff you can do behind closed doors, but it's pretty much zero. And that's a real shame. We helped train the first female tour guide in the history of Afghanistan, Fatima in Herat. She had to leave the country because she was deemed to be at risk. So to not address that is doing a disservice. On the flip side, with regard to actually organizing tourism, the security situation has improved massively, because the major anti-government group, the main group that potentially would have caused security risks to our groups in Afghanistan, is now the government. So they are not a threat in the way they were before. So there's lots of parts of the country that we can visit now that we couldn't visit before. So we're driving, we can visit the south, we can drive a lot more between cities, there's more access to places. So that's the situation there now, and that's the situation that we're working with.
So we sell travel to Iran, as you know, and from time to time it does come up with people saying that we shouldn't do it, right, for moral reasons, because, you know, obviously the situation is far from perfect in Iran as well. If we reflect on the protests, I mean, we're recording this in March 2023. If we reflect on the protests last year in 2022, you know, it caused quite a few people to ask us why we were doing it. Why are you doing it? Like, what's the answer you give to people who wonder about all this?
I mean, the way... there's a simple answer that I see some people give, which is like, oh, we're not political. We're not supporting the government. We're putting money into the hands of, you know, sort of entrepreneurial tourist people in the country that we visit. And that's kind of the end of the argument. And I find that argument a little bit sort of reductive and a little bit of burying their head in the sand. The way we see it is that, especially because we bring tourists to places that don't see a lot of tourists. So, you know, if we brought four groups a year to Egypt, the impact we would have on how tourism is perceived and how tourism works in Egypt would be zero, because there's already so much going on. When we take people to Yemen or Somalia or to Afghanistan, we're like quite a large part of the tourism industry. So we have a much wider responsibility, whatever the tourism industry is. I'm using sort of quotation marks on industry. So what the way I always looked at it is tourism or any kind of cultural interaction. So, you know, sports, music, any kind of cultural interaction, it normalizes things. And that normalization can be normalizing a regime. I mean, I think that people have less of an issue visiting the UAE or Thailand or Egypt that don't have democratically elected governments, because it becomes normal to visit these countries. They don't really think about the regime. They just go and do it. And so that potentially is a negative thing. But what it also does, it normalizes things for individuals. And I recently came back from Afghanistan, where we resumed our skiing again, where there was a ski competition that was started in 2011 that was managed, was supported quite a lot internationally, and now is just managed by the local boys up in the mountains. And by having some international skiers return, tourism is normal. And if you've come from a place where there's been conflict, where there's been quite a lot of misery, where you felt quite isolated, having that tourism return beyond the financial impact, which on a macro scale is pretty small, it creates an environment where you feel you're not isolated from the rest of the world, where people are coming to your country not because they need to fix it, but because they find it beautiful. And that's what we try and do. We try and maximize those kind of positive benefits and try and minimize any sort of interaction with governments and sort of supporting governments within it. So that's what we try and do. And within Afghanistan, as I said before, I mean, we helped train the first female tour guide within Afghanistan, who in turn tried to create a space for people to, for women to be able to step into a certain role, which they'd never done before. I personally was one of the founders of the Marathon of Afghanistan, which was the first and was the largest ever mixed gender sporting event in the history of Afghanistan. So to do things like that, it's not going to change the world, but I think through tourism and through Untamed Borders, we have a capacity to try and maximize the positives while minimizing the potential negative aspects. That's how I see it. It's not burying the head in the sand. It's not saying that tourism does nothing bad. But it's to try and do it as much of a force for good as possible.
Mm. Yeah, and you touched upon something important there, and it's just a bit of a case of, well, one way to help figure this sort of thing out would be to be like, well, what if we were to stop going? Would the net impact be positive of us stopping, or would it be negative, right? And it's pretty hard to think of too many examples where the impact would be positive, because pretty much everyone who takes the hit have nothing to do with what's going on. And the people who are in the governments, it actually politically in most cases reinforces them, right? Because there's this kind of, if everyone stops going, it's just like it's like an us against the world sort of thing sometimes. What do you think about that?
I mean, part of it is I work in tourism, and I'm quite happy to work in tourism. I'm not a diplomat and I'm not a development worker. So I can, I don't have to think too deeply on it. But to be honest, I think it works both ways. I mean, you look at, I know we're getting a bit off the subject here, but you look at South Africa being isolated internationally with apartheid. That was seen as a success. I mean, that hurt people individually. You know, they couldn't do business. The economy suffered. I see sanctions in Russia, and I know that it affects everyday people. But also I've spoken to people in the North Caucasus, in Chechnya and Dagestan, and they're like, yeah, it suffers us, but actually I'm glad that it also hurts the oligarchs. Like, they can't do what they used to be able to do. They can't go to Saint-Tropez. They can't do all the kind of fun things. Their yachts have been impounded. I'm like, I'm glad that like that has happened. So these kind of sanctions, these kind of effects, they affect everyone. And to sort of, again, say that it doesn't affect things, it doesn't change things, is a smaller argument. Like with most things in life, once you start digging in it, there's positives and negatives. And I think that's what we always try and do with our travel, is just to accentuate the positives. And,
right, just to maximize the positive impact,
Maximize the positives. And I mean, if I was too worried about it, I mean, look, at the end of the day, tourism, what do? We use fossil fuels to go flying around the world to get a little bit of extra joy out of life. I mean, part of me is like, I should just give up if I really felt that way too strongly. So I'm probably not the most objective person to talk to either. You know,
well, this is good.
Tour operators.
Now, this is good. Yeah, I like what you're saying. It does make a lot of sense, and the nuanced answer is more likely to be correct, even if it's less likely to grab a headline. So all right. We've talked about Afghanistan a bit, but you go to quite a few more places than that. I'll just ask one of the questions I just must ask, right? Out of all the countries you run to, which is the one that's the most actually, quote unquote, genuinely dangerous and requires serious security planning?
I mean, we assess risk in lots of different ways. And I would say, overall, the trips that I probably have most concern about are the ones in, probably to Somalia, to Mogadishu. Because there's something, basically the accommodation is something that is not, there's only so many places to stay in Mogadishu. And, you know, when we choose something, you know, when we used to stay in Kabul when it was a bit risky, like, there were loads of small guest houses you could stay in. Like, there were the two big hotels that had been attacked. There were certain places where there were long-term international guests. There were things like this. But you could kind of stay away from that. In Mogadishu, there's a handful of hotels where everyone goes. The politicians go. International people go. Like, all of them are potential targets. And there's no real way of getting around that. I mean, and we're open with the guests about it. They've got great security. They've got all these stuff, but they do get attacked by Al-Shabaab. And that's a risk that has to be taken in traveling to Mogadishu. And I don't think there's ways, and I'm not going to talk too much detail about it here in a public format. There's ways that we can reduce the risk and where we stay and how we rotate the accommodation that we stay in. But ultimately, I would say, probably the trips that we do to Mogadishu, we work. It's not that it takes that much effort to organize them, because we have a system of working and we're quite restrictive on what we can do. And it's like, here's the trip. It's like 2 nights and you go and you see this and you see this, and we might change the order we do it. We might change the hotel, but ultimately the way that we work and the way our security team and guides work is the same every time. So it's not actually that difficult to organize, because there's not that many moving parts, but it's probably the place with the biggest, probably the biggest risk.
What kind of person goes to Mogadishu?
Well, I think this is, see, when we began, I mean, we were guiding in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and for me, it was just about the region. It was about guiding in the region and doing, you know, expanding a bit into Iran and parts of India and Central Asia. And then we'd get requests from people that went to Afghanistan. Oh, can you organize this in Chechnya, in Grozny, or in Mogadishu, or something like that? And because I'd developed contacts within the sort of conflict media world and the development world and things like that, you know, people go to places and you can do it. And we would be like, okay, well, what do you want to do there? And often the guests are like, I don't know, they just wanted to go. I don't know why. Some people just curiosity. Want to go somewhere. Curiosity.
Yeah.
And so we'd create something. We'd be like, well, you don't just want to go to Grozny. You want to go to see these incredible watchtowers in North Ossetia. And you want to go to Ingushetia and go to Dagestan and go to Derbent, this amazing walled city that's half in Europe and half in Asia that separated Persia from the Russians. It's like this thin strip of city between the sea and the mountains. Like, so we created itineraries based on sort of what I thought curious people would like. And then people go on those trips and we'd share on social media and with our communities, and other people would be like, oh, that looks interesting, and they'd do it. And suddenly you create for want of a better term, this is an industry podcast, a product. Mm. And people like the idea of the product. And I think that's part of it. I mean, I talked before about people wanting to see somewhere that's without the prism of tourism. And once you start getting into that and you wanting to see that, people start looking around. What else? Where else can I go? Where else can I go that's not seen through that prism of tourism? And somehow someone finds themselves going to Mogadishu, I guess.
Yeah. It makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense, right? There's just people who want to go to every country in the world, and that would require visiting Somalia, right? Then there's just people who just love going to places that other people don't go.
I think it's a combination of those people. And also from a business perspective, you know, especially in travel, you know how it is, Matt. If someone likes what you do, you know, they like your trip to Iran. They're like, well, I want to go with these guys to Uzbekistan because I like how they do it. I like how they manage it. I felt they did a good job. Whatever your concerns are, that, you know, maybe it's a security concern, maybe it's the, you know, the standard of the guiding or how they manage issues or whatever. If someone likes you, then they might want to work with you or travel with you again. And so they look at where else, where other places that you go. So it works like that as well sometimes.
Nice. So I'm going to ask you a question, but I'm going to answer the question first, just to see.
Saves me. I'll make a cup of tea. You can do that.
Well, basically, so I want to ask you, what places are you excited about right now? Because I know you must get the what's your favorite country in the world all the time question, but that's a hard question to answer. But what am I excited about right now? That's a different question. I definitely can answer that one, right? So I haven't been to Kurdistan in Iraq, but that's one place that I'm super excited to visit. I'm really, really hoping to visit this year. There's a trail called the Zagros Trail. I'm not sure if you've heard about this project that's being developed, and that's quite cool. And yeah, I'm thinking of visiting, checking out the Zagros Trail, seeing if we can create a product in collaboration with some local partners. So that's my answer. What are you excited about at the moment?
No, I think the Zagros Trail is great. I mean, we've had some people do parts of it.
Interesting.
The couple that have helped develop it, oh my God, I forget his name, the Northern Irish dude.
His name is escaping me as well.
His name has escaped me. He's also did the film's not out. They did an incredible expedition on a boat from sort of source to sea down the Tigris River. I think his book about it is out.
Yeah, Leon McCarron. I've got the name.
Leon McCarron. Yeah. So Leon and his partner, who's an amazing photographer. People should follow her on. Her name escapes me as well. If you follow Leon on Leon McCarron on Instagram, you should follow his partner. I think it's Emily Garthwaite. I think that's her name.
Okay.
She takes some amazing pictures. She had some very recent photos from Nowruz, the Kurdish in Kurdistan and Persian in the rest of the world, New Year, in Acre, where there's this huge torch lit procession up the mountain. But no, his book on sailing the length of the Tigris River. So, you know, from Turkey through parts of Kurdish Syria, Rojava, and then through all the way down Iraq, through the marshes and down to the sea. So I can't wait for that to come out.
It's coming out actually on April 6th. You're giving a bit of free publicity over here. It's called Wounded Tigris or Tigris. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. By Leon McCarron. It's a journey across the entire length of the Tigris.
Absolutely. I can't wait to see it because he's a great guy. You're excited about Kurdistan. I'm excited about Kurdistan. And also, if more plugs, not for me plugs, but about this time last year, I traveled and organized the logistics for Michael Palin. He did a series called Into Iraq.
That was you.
We arranged, we arranged the logistics for him as well. So that's worth checking out. I don't know if you've seen it, Matt, but anyway, your listeners should check that out if they want to see a bit more about
that. He wrote an accompanying book, and I read the book a couple of months ago. I loved it.
Well, you should read it again. I'm in it. You'll see me mentioned a couple of times.
I must have. That actually may have been how I heard of you a few months ago. No, I've heard of you a long time ago. I can't remember. It all jumbles together. But I definitely, now that I think about it, I definitely, it's ringing bells. I read most of the book in a single sitting. So it's obviously things are going to blur together. But it was fascinating to read, obviously, of Palin's journey through Iraq, and that's definitely lifted my curiosity to go not just to Kurdistan but to the rest of Iraq as well.
But I think the Zagros trip, I think it's a really great project. I think that's not a bad thing for you to try and get involved in. It's really nice. Kurdistan is really nice. What am I excited about? That's what you were asking. I'm excited about I think the things that I've always been excited about are when we're developing something new. Like, I was really excited when we did the marathon in Afghanistan. I was also involved in a marathon in Somaliland, which ran for 3 years, and again was the only mixed gender sporting event in the country. To do something that's kind of pioneering is always really exciting. I don't have any projects like that lined up at the moment, but without going back to Afghanistan too much, there's lots of the country now that we couldn't visit before because of security reasons, which we can now. And we are just starting to develop, sort of new, again, for an industry term, products. Like, how are we managing this? How are we going to create this? So, for example, this sort of central route of Afghanistan, which we did in 2008, 2009, but then we couldn't do because of security. We've started doing again, and it goes from Kabul, which is kind of in the east of the country, to Herat, which is on the Iranian border in the west. And on the way through, it visits a place called the Minaret of Jam, which is a 63-meter high minaret, just in the middle of nowhere. It's like 14 hours drive from the nearest paved road. And it's the second highest kind of medieval minaret in the world, which is phenomenal. It's like a UNESCO site. And like, how we manage that, you know, because there's nowhere to stay. So, and there's no, you know, there's no sort of outfitters locally that are like, oh yeah, we've got the tents, we've got all this kind of stuff. It's developing it literally from the ground up with the drivers, how they're going to cook, how we're going to serve the food. What are we going to camp? Are we going to stay in a tea house nearby? What are the benefits of both? Like really sort of starting it from the nuts and bolts. And that's really exciting because Afghanistan's a big country with a lot of history and a lot of geography. And even people that know it, I probably know it as well as anyone with regards to tourism. I've been doing it for 15 years. There's loads of stuff we've never done and people haven't done and the odd individual has done. So that's really exciting. I'm also quite excited about the stuff we're doing in Yemen on the mainland. That's all quite new. There's this area in Wadi Dawan where we want to try and do some little sort of hiking trip there, which again is something that's not really been done before. And yeah, that's pretty.
That's awesome.
That's pretty exciting.
Far out. You're getting excited over here. I'm just about ready to quit my job and go overseas, but I can't. I've got a business. Yeah, that's awesome. And I think there's a few people listening to this podcast who are starting to, those curiosity feelers, right? The curiosity antenna is starting to rise when it comes to Afghanistan a little bit. That's for sure. Just got to convince you that you've got to convince your other half sometimes, perhaps, who knows, or as you can do what I'm planning on doing it someday, just rock up and then inform your other half from the destination. Save yourself a lot of anxiety. That's really cool. What is the situation like in Yemen? Obviously, that's another destination that's just known for war lately.
So the conflict in Yemen has been brutal, and that's the affected area is most of the populated part of the country. So confusingly, Yemen because historically, when Yemen was North and South Yemen up until the end of the kind of the Cold War, North Yemen was sort of backed by the West, and South Yemen was backed sort of by the Soviet Union. However, if you look on a map, they look like East and West, basically. Right. You know, the most northern bit of South Yemen is further north than the most northern bit of North Yemen, for example. So that's why it's a little bit confusing. So, but I'm going to use East and West, even though politically it's North and South. So most people live in the western half of Yemen, the bit that's closest to the Red Sea. This is where Sana'a is the capital, it's where Aden is, it's where the most populated area. So that all of those areas have suffered horrendously in the last 8 years, and it's a real tragedy. On the flip side of that, you have the island of Socotra off the south coast of Yemen. And Socotra, quite accurately, is kind of pitched as the Galapagos of the Middle East. It has a huge number of indigenous and endemic plants, birds, and little bits of wildlife. It's famous for these dragon blood trees. It's famous for these sort of bottle trees. Any Googling of Socotra, you'll see some incredible sort of scenery. Yeah. It's got amazing coastline.
Crazy.
It's got amazing coastline. And in the middle, it's got this high plateau where you have all the dragon blood trees. And there's just a lot to do there. And Socotra has escaped, because of its remote location, it's escaped the violence. And now there's a weekly flight from Abu Dhabi. And it's just great. It's just genuinely a wonderful sort of predominantly sort of paradise island. So we take people to Socotra, and we also take people to the mainland of Yemen, but the area, the two provinces that are closest to Oman. So that's Al Mahra province and the Hadramut province. And Hadramut is one of the jewels of Yemen. There's a town called Shibam, which is known as whatever, the Manhattan of the Middle East, it's like these sort of 13-story skyscrapers in this kind of one block just in the middle of the desert. The reason that these were built was the Yemenis made lots of money from trading, and that's where the money was made, on the coast, but the coast is really humid. So if they built their sort of cities inland. Sana'a is at an altitude as well. But if you build these big skyscrapers, as anyone who knows who's been in New York or La City in London or whatever, the wind sort of whips between them, and it can be quite chilly in cities that are built of skyscrapers. So that's why they built them really high. It's not because they were running out of space. It's because they wanted to create shade and cooling breezes. So you've got this place called Shibam. There's all these little villages in Wadi Dawan. They're just so sort of picturesque. And yeah, that area, again, has kind of escaped most of the conflict. So whilst it's tragic what's happening in Yemen, it's possible to... The whole country hasn't been involved. And I guess that's part of what we do. You know, countries are much more nuanced than just everything is at war. There are parts that are possible to visit, especially when countries are so big and there's huge deserts and mountain ranges in between. There's always bits that... Not always, but there's often areas that you can visit with relative safety.
What's a country where that not always applies? As in, is there a country that is just, you just cannot in good conscience send a group there based on your assessment?
Like a country?
I can imagine there's regions, but...
Yeah, absolutely regions. I mean, off the top of my head, I mean, the answer is... I mean, I can't give too much detail about it, but I'm working on a project for somebody that involves visiting every country in the world and doing something in every country in the world. And David, no, I mean, at the moment, currently, no, I don't think there's a country. There's definitely regions. There's definitely places, regions that are, you know, yeah, of course, there's places where there's active conflict going on, which you wouldn't be able to visit. But I don't think there's like a one country which, in good consciousness, we could say there's no part of that country you could visit with a relative degree of safety at the moment.
Can I ask you some nuts and bolts questions? This is
Absolutely.
Kind of industry jamming, but money. Not all of these countries you're talking about are connected with the international banking system, right?
Yes, that's correct, yes.
So how do you manage that?
You can manage that in a number of different ways. We have group trips in which an international guide goes out to countries. So sometimes money is taken in cash. There are money transfer systems between countries. There are sometimes people will have an office set up in a neighboring country that you can pay money to. Generally, the answer I put is with difficulty, but that's part of what we do.
That's the value you provide. Yeah.
That's the value we provide. And there are, I mean, what's the word? Necessity is the mother of invention, right? Hmm. I mean, people that live in places where internet gets blocked or things are censored are experts at VPNs and how to get around that kind of stuff. So people that work in countries where the banking system doesn't link up with the rest of the international banking system are experts at navigating that.
Right. Yes.
I think that's what to say. You work in Iran. I think you have some knowledge of how this kind of works.
Ish. The person who gets the money into Iran for us, I don't know how he does it. So, and this is a thing, right? Because it's not illegal. Like, there's no sanctions on Iranian, on tourism to Iran, right? There's sanctions on other stuff when it comes to Iran. There's sanctions on tourism, and I've checked this out. I've double checked it. I've triple checked it. I've confirmed it with my bank. But because they're disconnected from the international banking system, number one, that makes it very hard. And number two, any transaction that has obviously Iran in a description, right? Like some sort of interbank transfer that automatically gets flagged. We've discovered that a few times. Having to train our guests not to put that anywhere on their payment, on their payments. But we have a guy we work with who just gets it in when it comes to Iran. But when I was in Iran, we talked about it a lot, and it just seems that there's just many, many, I guess, ways, right? There's just like all sorts of get-arounds that people have having bank accounts in France or Switzerland or something like that. And then after a few years, they get shut down by their banks. So they just walk down the street, open another bank account and go for another few years and so on and so forth. But yeah, bags of cash, we haven't gotten to that level yet.
If anyone, there's only so many times you can use this map, but I'll give this to you. If the bank flags it and they said, oh yeah, but look, someone, you're one of your, what customers has put as the reference Iran, IRAN, you just say, oh, there was a misspelling. They meant to put IBAN, which is the International Banking account. You can't use that all the time, but that's a free one from me to you. That's one that we're
right.
getting.
Thank you.
They just misspelt it. But there's a word you'll hear a lot in the sort of wider Islamic world, and that's called hawala. I don't know if you come across this term. Hawala is the traditional historical kind of Western Union, effectively.
Oh, and wait, so is this like buying jewelry or something like that? No?
No.
I got that wrong. So what? Okay, I'll stop interrupting.
So basically, you'll have hawala offices all over the world. You'll have it. Right. There'll be some in Australia. There'll be some in the UK. And they're not. It's unofficial. It's not. And because it doesn't have any checks, because it doesn't have any financial authority checks, I guess it's technically illegal. And I'm not saying that we use it. We don't use it. But I'm just saying this exists. And effectively, it used to be, because back in the day, even the days of the Silk Road and trading throughout sort of Central Asia, it was dangerous on the roads. It was dangerous to carry lots of money. And so you'd have these guys in each city, one in Samarkand, one in Bukhara, one in Kabul, one in Tehran. And they would effectively issue chits of paper to the traders. And then when they got, someone would deposit whatever, 1,000 somethings in rupees in Delhi, and they'd get a chit of a chit of something, and they'd turn up in Kabul, and they could reclaim that money. And then these hawala guys would meet up every couple of years, exchange all their chits, and divvy up all of the cash. And obviously, they take money within it. So that was the old hawala system back in the day, and it still exists. It still exists in that you can go to a hawala office. It's not advertised anywhere, and if you're Matt, and you go to a Iranian hawala office in I don't know where you are, Sydney, Melbourne, wherever you sit, you probably get told that it doesn't exist and told to get out of town.
Hawala's a dessert, and we don't make the dessert. You're confused.
Exactly. But people use it all the time. People use it, especially it's hugely used in Afghanistan because the banking system doesn't work. So yeah, it's a traditional money transfer system, and this is often how people do it. And in fact, there's one called Dahab Shil in Somalia. It's really big. I mean, they have offices all over the world. And that was set up informally. That was an informal hawala system, which they then, formalized, turned into a bank, got all their like financial accreditation, and became the biggest sort of money transfer and banking system in Somalia. And it's big all over the Horn of Africa.
Well, just Googled them and on the website, and all transfers are fee-free with a promo code Ramadan23. So I guess that means you have to sign up before the end of Ramadan. So yeah, these guys, the website looks legit. It's amazing. That's incredible.
So they're a legit hawala system. Absolutely.
Wow. That's awesome. All right. I'm happy you asked that question. Now, insurance, both for you and for your guests. How do you work through that?
So, I mean, insurers insure stuff. Do you know what I mean? I mean, that's what they do. We're not the first company to be working in the countries that we're working in. So we have a UK insurer that has a product that actually covers kind of what we do. It covers adventure travel. It has an understanding of places with FCO, which is our Foreign Office government travel warnings, and we put in what we need, and they give us, you know, third party cover based on that. So that's our own business insurance. As far as travelers are concerned, yeah, there's a bunch of companies that offer travel to places. I mean, because most travel insurance is null and void if you're going to a place with government travel warnings. That's your sort of standard travel policy. But there are a number of insurers that will insure if people go to those areas. Some of them have a policy that they won't cover if the incident involves the reason why you're not supposed to travel. So, you know, if you get hit by a car, that's fine. Or if you come down with, you know, stomach problems and things, they'll cover you for that. But if the reason you're not supposed to travel is because there's an insurgency going on and you get blown up by a bomb, they won't cover you for that. So each policy is slightly different. But there are insurers that do it. Yeah, I think that's...
Are there any particular companies that you'd recommend?
I always say because when we offer it to our guests, we're not an insurance broker, so I'm never supposed to offer advice about companies. But we list people that they've used in the past. I mean, there's a company called Battleface that does a lot of work. There's Global Underwriters. There's one that is a bit like IATA, IATA, but it's not. I think it's IATI. There's a company called Global Rescue. They're a rescue policy rather than a medical policy, but they're very well renowned. So off the top of my head, those four are quite commonly used by our guests.
Nice. Have you heard of Campbell Irvine Direct? Is that a company that rings a bell for you?
Yep, that's a company name. Extremely well respected, especially in the field of... people working, I think, sort of journalists, a lot of conflict media people, I think, use them.
Right. Yeah, we've had some issues in the past when we're looking for insurance where some of them will only cover UK citizens or something like that. not too many options available for Australian citizens, but if I guess if one looks hard enough, you'll find it. With Iran, and I guess you'd be aware of this, but for those who are listening, Iran has its own certified insurance scheme, right? And there's tons of online resellers of that. It's one of the things where people inquire with us that they're surprised at how easy it is. You just Google Iran travel insurance. There's like tons of results. It's like $30 or $40 for 2 weeks. And I think I'm pretty sure all of the policies are underwritten by the exact same company in Iran. At least that's how it appears to me. I don't know if you can contradict that. But overall, that has been relatively simple. When it comes to going to Iran, that seems like it's almost been one of the things that's the least of the headache, right? But for Somalia, sorry, you were saying? I can see you opening your mouth.
Yeah. I mean, as you know, the reason for this is the same reason you have problems is because most of the hospitals, not most of them, but some hospitals in Iran are run by the state. For a international insurer to do the insurance, they would then, you know, they would have to pay the hospital back for the treatment. So they would effectively be paying the Iranian state potentially for the treatment, which is illegal. And so that's why it kind of has to be an Iranian insurer to get around that kind of legal loophole. But often what I've found over the last 15 years is a new insurer that decides to cover places with government advice comes on the market. And everything's great for a while, and then they start putting in exceptions. And often Australia is an exception that comes up. New York is also an exception, but that's understandable. New Yorkers are some of the most litigious people in the world, and I think they just claim. Do you know what I mean? They just claim, yeah. And it's just not worth the money doing it. Why Australians? I don't know. Maybe you guys you like to claim on your insurance. I'm not sure what it is, but usually when you cut out people from certain countries, it's because it just doesn't make... I mean, insurers just about the money. They just crunch the money, don't they, the actuarians? And maybe Australians love claiming. That's all I can think of.
Yeah, I can... Yeah, I know that some of our guests don't hesitate to do it. I think one thing, and I've never really worked with American guests, but I know that Australia has a culture of buying travel insurance, right? Like, it's... The idea of not buying travel insurance, like it's most people do it, and you don't even have to tell them to do it. They just know they got to do it. Mm. Whereas in my interactions with American operators, like many Americans have never even thought of this as a concept, and many don't buy travel insurance, which to me is nuts, right? But perhaps because it's so ingrained in our culture, then the other half of the coin as well, claiming against it, is also ingrained. I'm not sure. I've never tried it myself. I've never trusted them to actually go through with it. And there's always, as you can imagine, there's always many exceptions and many things, bad things that happen to you aren't covered, but the average person wants to have at least something in place.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think you're right with people from the US. I don't think with someone from the UK or from Australia or New Zealand or most of the people from European countries, you have to explain what travel insurance is. Whereas certainly with some guests from the US. But then again, you know, how kind of health insurance and how stuff, all insurance in the US is kind of quite fragmented and it's a bit awkward. Whereas, you know, in the UK and Australia, it's like, you know, everyone knows their health is covered in their own country. You don't have to worry about that. But as soon as you step overseas, as soon as you step off the island, it's like every man for themselves. Whereas I think in the US, everyone's gone through, you know, a lot of people have gone through a phase where they just don't have any health insurance. And it's just a risk some people in the country have to take. But, you know, they just can't afford it or how it works. So it doesn't feel as stepping so much into the unknown as it would in the UK. And I also understand that it's not, as a tour operator in the UK, and I'm sure it's the same in Australia, it's a legal requirement that we have to make sure our guests have health insurance, medical insurance when they travel with us.
Actually, I don't think it is a legal requirement for Australians, but it is it's a requirement of everyone's insurance provider, right? So this is what happens, right? So they deregulated the travel industry a while back in Australia, and there's not too many travel industry specific rules anymore in terms of how travel companies are allowed to manage their businesses. But because insurance companies set the rules, right? like all of our suppliers require it. There's no exceptions. Everyone requires insurance for the guests, but that's because their own insurance company forces them to require us to have it, if that makes sense. So I've never even had to think about the rules from a government perspective because we haven't even gotten that far. So, yeah.
But I think maybe in the US I just don't think it's a thing. Yeah. I just don't.
Those crazy Americans. So, all right, this has been a good chat so far, but there's one question I definitely need to ask, and it's relating to a circumstance that we do go through from time to time, and you must go through from time to time, and that is, people are booked in to go on a trip to a particular place that you offer. That destination appears in the news. Some terrible event has happened, such as, you know, pre-COVID example, Donald Trump assassinating the Iranian general. And then the Iranians shooting that plane out of the sky accidentally, right? If you might remember that, all that's been kind of forgotten because of what happens shortly afterwards with the dreaded coronavirus that came straight after it. You must be going through that sort of circumstance quite regularly. How do you manage that as a business? The negative headlines and the response to that.
No, I remember. What's his name? Kasimi. Soleimani. I remember very well. We had trips to Iraq at the time, or shortly afterwards. So it was exactly this. I mean, from an internal perspective. We look at risk. We try to look at it in a calm way. And sometimes things that make the headlines they're not the things that affect the risk on the trip, and sometimes things that don't make the headlines do affect it massively. And so, for example, I mean, that example is a bit difficult because it did create a lot of unknowns. No one was sure how that might escalate. Like, he was a huge figure in Iranian politics. I mean, it's like, I'm not gonna give an equivalent in Australian politics. I don't think you have anything like that, but he was a huge figure, and he was essentially assassinated. I mean, let's the rights and the wrongs are of that. But sometimes we'll have it like we talked about hotels. So, you know, in Baghdad, we will stay in certain type of hotels which are fairly low, you know, a lower profile and this, that, and the other. And maybe in Baghdad, either the high-profile hotel, which we've already assessed that we wouldn't want to stay in because high-profile people stay there, or, which happened quite a bit, the U.S. Embassy gets, you know, some rockets fired at it in the green zone. We would just simply set out our assessment of risk. Like, we'd like, this is what we understand that this is, you know... this has happened and you might be concerned about it, but this is something, although, you know, it's tragic, but it's something, this kind of attack against a high profile target in the capital or a government target is something that we expect. Like, we expect it to happen because it's happened in the past. We expect it to happen again. And these are the precautions that we've already taken to reduce that risk, and then, you know, we'll continue to update them and things like that. So if it's something that is within our assessment of risk, then we just explain how we do it. And ultimately, the places that we guide, you can't convince someone to go to Baghdad or to Yemen or to Afghanistan. I mean, people generally want to go, but they want to understand the risks and how we manage them. So it's effectively just laying out how we are. I mean, the difficulty is when somebody really wants to cancel because they feel that the situation has changed significantly and we don't feel the situation has changed significantly. And obviously our terms are that if we cancel it, obviously people get their money back. And if they cancel it, well, then it's our terms and conditions. And we'll try and meet people in a fair way. Sometimes people are not happy with that. I mean,
I understand. We just had someone cancel a run because of all the noise around people being, schoolgirls being potentially poisoned, right, in schools. And they were quite worried about protests enveloping or developing. And I was just like, you've got 3 months. Let's just wait it out. And I don't think it's going to impact us anyway, but let's just wait it out. But it was just kind of like a tipping thing for her. It just took her over the edge. She's like, no, I can't do this. And I think this comes back to marketing and setting expectations at the very start, right? If you're selling Iraq, yeah, I fully understand. But there's destinations where I think it's tempting to be like, no, don't worry about it too much. You know, we've got it all under control. And then I think in some cases we've accidentally maybe been too persuasive. She should never have booked the trip because she was worried about it. Or when she booked, she was a little bit worried about it, asking a lot of questions about foreign travel advice and security and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, there's a couple of news events that she was rocked by every single time. And we've started being much more direct with people when they ask these kinds of questions. And it's like, look, if you're asking it because you're worried about it, you should just know when you book, you're going to be seeing these headlines three times as much. And all your friends are going to start sending you every single negative news about Iran that they see. And if you're not ready for that, it's going to destroy the anticipation of the trip. So I think that's a bit of a lesson learned for us, actually, in terms of making sure that we have the guests that actually are, like you said, genuinely committed to going, as opposed to 99%.
Yeah, but you know how it is, Matt. I mean, you can't.
Yeah.
You don't know what anyone's like when they first contact. Like you
that's
this,
right.
This kind of appears and reveals itself. And I think you're right. I mean, one of the things we have on our responses is, although it's very easy to, and it's a very handy shortcut to say, oh, you know, is it safe? Yeah, it's safe. That doesn't exist. Like, nobody in our office is allowed to say something is safe or unsafe. Like, it's like, these are the risks. This is what we do to minimize the risks that what we consider to be an acceptable level. And you'll get people, and sometimes you get people, they'll be email, they'll basically be wanting you to tell them it's okay. Like, you know that. You can feel the exchange. Like, just tell me it's okay and I'll book. And it's like, that's not how it works. Do you know what I mean? That's not like, we're not in control of Al-Shabaab. We're not in control of ISIS. We're not in control of people protesting for their civil liberties and rights in the countries that we visit. Like, we can work in ways that reduces the risk of that impacting us. Absolutely. But to think that, oh, someone said, oh, it's fine. If you travel with James, he'll make it safe. I'm like, I can't make it safe. I'm like one guy.
You're not a
it doesn't work like that. We don't change the environment. The environment is what it is. But we can inform people of how we see that environment and what we do to reduce the risk in it. And that's the basis of all of our correspondence on that. Because to start talking in any other way just isn't correct. And some people don't want that. They want you to say it's safe, everything's fine, and that doesn't exist. But I know what you mean. Sometimes you look back and like, could we have managed this in a better way? Could we have corresponded this better way? And in 15 years of doing it, there are better ways of doing it, but you will always have this come up. It's just the nature of the beast.
It's true. You can't eliminate it. We must stop, I'm sorry to say. I've gone past my time limit. But James, it's been a pleasure talking. Untamed Borders, for anyone who's forgotten the name of your company. If anyone wants to reach out to you, what's the best way to do that?
The best way is to go to the website, which is www.untamedborders.com. You can email us at info@untamedborders.com, and we're on the usual social media, and all of them are at untamedborders.com. So you can interact with us in any of those formats.
And do you ever work as a DMC?
Yep, we do. So we work as a local provider in some places for other companies. And we also work, yeah, so we do work as a DMC. It's not a huge part of our business, but we do it.
Okay. Might be some operators out there that are curious, so I'm happy you asked that question. Good. All right. Thank you very much, James. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks for having me on.